Ave Maria Press has been publishing Catholic books and resources for more than 150 years, and they are located right on the north side of the Notre Dame campus. Visit AveMariaPress.com for a wide selection of spirituality books, classic Catholic literature, and even books for families. You can also find podcasts and free downloadable Catholic content. Visit AveMariaPress.com and receive 25% off your order with code REDEEMER. Ave Maria Press, helping people to know, love, and serve God.
Church Life Today is a production of Spoke Street Media and the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame, and is brought to you in part by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union and our listeners.
When you hold a position of authority in Catholic education, and you believe that the number one goal of Catholic schools is to evangelize, then that affects everything you do. It affects who you hire and why. It affects what your priorities are, how you think about curriculum and culture, and what you value in the hard decisions you have to make in times of trial or crisis. You give an account of why the kind of education you provide matters by what you place as your number one goal, not just in print or in theory, but in practice. My guest today is shaping one of the largest and oldest Catholic school systems in the United States with precisely that goal in mind. Thomas Carroll is Secretary of Education and Superintendent of Catholic Schools in the Archdiocese of Boston. A longtime leader in education and in community development, Mr. Carroll has been leading Catholic schools in Boston since 2019. As for me, I'm Leonard DiLorenzo. This is Church Life Today, a production of the McGrath Institute for Church Life and the Spoke Street Media Network. I'm glad you're here. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate being on.
You're completing your third full year alongside Cardinal O'Malley and leading Catholic education in the Archdiocese of Boston, but you've actually been crisscrossing the country conducting a national talent search looking for the right people to lead and teach in the Archdiocese's schools. So I'd love to ask you, what are you looking for? Who are you looking for in this search?
Yeah, just first a little just about the scale that we're dealing with in Boston. It's one of the larger archdioceses. We have 101 schools, 32,500 kids, 3,000 teachers, and 1,200 support staff. So it's a pretty big enterprise. And right now, for a variety of reasons, including COVID, there's a pretty serious teacher shortage, not just in our area, but across the country. And so I'm looking around for essentially the best and the brightest around the country. And I'm recruiting people that not just, we obviously have interactions with education schools throughout the archdiocese and around the country, but I'm also looking for people who haven't taught at all. And so my pitch, if you will, to these students who are now seniors is essentially in the 1960s, if you had missionary zeal, you would join the Peace Corps. The 1980s, you probably would have signed up for Teach for America. So now I'm asking people if they're Catholic and serious about their faith and want to teach in Boston, that's a similar kind of experience right now. I'm looking for people that are faithful, that are willing to be witnesses for their faith in the classroom, that will speak openly about their faith to children. Our number one goal of Catholic schools is to evangelize the faith, to bring children closer to Jesus Christ, and hopefully individually to bring them closer to eternal salvation. So it definitely starts with faith first in terms of hiring. We're also looking for people who are smart, intelligent, people who are intellectually curious, which sounds like a funny criteria for a teacher, but not all teachers I've met are actually intellectually curious. And I don't see how you can inspire intellectual curiosity in a child if you're not intellectually curious yourself. So I'm looking for the kind of people who can't, you know, walk by a bookstore without stopping and buying a book to consume. Even if I know my own case, they stack up over time and I don't always get to everyone I buy. But people who just have an incredible thirst for knowledge and just things related to the intellectual life. And I'm looking for, you know, a serious work ethic. I mean, teaching is a very, very difficult craft, but I also think it's one of the worthiest things that you could do. And so I'm asking the teachers I'm hiring for kind of a handshake agreement that they'd be with us for at least 2 years, her to be worth all the time I'm spending crisscrossing the country to find them and also to train them up. But, and after that, whatever God's plan is for them, whether it's to stay in the, as in the vocation of a teacher, or whether they want to move along to a job, whether it's an assistant principal or dean of students, dean of academics, or ultimately a principal, I'm open to all those possibilities, or we'll just help them get a job somewhere else if they decide they want to move somewhere else. But we need them in Boston right now. We have roughly 300 teaching opportunities a year. And because I'm sitting atop a large collection of schools, the advantage of coming to Boston versus hooking up with an individual school kind of randomly across the country is if, for example, you decide to teach fifth grade and you decide at the end of the year that you really wish you had taught seventh grade instead. And if the seventh grade teacher in your school isn't leaving, you're kind of forced to, you know, perhaps move to another community in order to realize your revised dream. In the case of Boston, we have so many schools. If fourth grade is not working out, give me a phone call. I could switch you to seventh grade pretty quickly, or, you know, in either direction. You want to work in a single gender school or a co-ed school. You want to work in a, we have the only all boys Catholic choir school in the entire country. We have classical academies. We have schools that are on the progressive side of the spectrum, and we have schools that are very traditional as well. So almost any kind of educational philosophy you could think of is represented in the mix of schools we have. And we also have a very diverse geography. So we have 144 towns and cities. We are geographically the largest school district in the state. Almost 70% of all kids in Catholic schools in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts are being educated in the Archdiocese of Boston. So there's just a lot of different kinds of places you could live. We in the South, we're bounded by Plymouth, Mass, as in the Mayflower, go up to the New Hampshire border. And then from Boston Harbor going westward, it's, you know, it's like 3.5 hours top to bottom, and going westward is about an hour and a half. So if you want to live in a rural area or a suburban area, or, you know, a trendy area like the Seaport, where you want to be on the ocean, or you want to be, you know, landlocked, or you're a hiker, like we have everything here. So I think it's really, and Boston is a young town, kind of like DC is, and, you know, a few other places around the country, like Austin, for example. So I think it's a pretty cool place for a young person to live. And there's a lot of deeply faithful people here. We've kind of been beaten down by the abuse scandal over the years, but there's a lot of organizations that spend a lot of time on evangelizing young adults. And so this is really robust faith community here that I think would be very attractive to an awful lot of people to be part of that.
Absolutely. As you were speaking about who you're looking for, you said you'd love to find the best and the brightest, but they don't necessarily need to be experienced yet as teachers. This can be the beginning of their teaching career. Like you said, you know, 30 years ago, it might have been the Peace Corps, or 15 years ago, it might have been Teach for America. And now you want those young, sort of zealous people to come here, bring their zeal here. Can I ask, how are you training new teachers for their first year on the job? Any, as every educator knows, your first year is hard no matter what in a new place. But as their first year teaching at all, how are you training them or preparing them to succeed?
Yeah, first of all, I'm trying to mentally prepare them by being honest with them about, they're probably going to be crying on their pillows, whether they're male or female, at some point during the school year. So we're allowing a limited number of schools to compete for the talent that I'm recruiting around the country. And the reason I'm doing that is I'm looking for a very serious commitment to mentor the spanking new teaching prospects that we're bringing in. And so they have to, at a minimum, commit a substantial amount of time as a school leader personally, and also to dedicate one of the more experienced seasoned teachers as a dedicated mentor for all the new teachers that they recruit out of this initial cohort. And then we will be hiring a mentor centrally. We're calling this program the St. Thomas More Teaching Fellows. St. Thomas More, because one, he was obviously devoutly Catholic, but he was also brave. And to be ostentatiously Catholic amidst the culture that we're sitting in right now requires a certain element of bravery, because almost every tenet of Catholicism is in the modern culture considered controversial and debatable. And so we're looking for people that are confident in their faith and willing to pass on that confidence and joy to other people. But the summertime is going to be a series of experiences that I'm crafting now to, in a sense, kind of a boot camp for teachers. So between roughly July 4th and The two-week period before Labor Day is generally when all of our schools have professional development. Almost all of our schools start the day after Labor Day. There are a couple exceptions. So all that time before that two-week school-based training comes about, we will have all of these newbies, if you will, in our custody, and we'll be working with them. Obviously, just teach them like physically the art of teaching, how to get children to stay focused and behave as we expect them in Catholic schools, but also really foundational things, how to do a lesson plan, how to think through curriculum, how to align curriculum across multiple grades, the nuts and bolts of which every teacher in America has to master over time. And then we're also doing Saturday programs throughout the year. So in addition to our centralized mentor that is going to be helping everybody in the cohort and visiting their schools and sitting in their classrooms and giving them ongoing advice, in addition to the mentor who's school-based, we also will be doing ongoing training of them throughout the year. Because some of the limitations of the summer training before they start is a lot of it is theoretical, although we are setting up live classes throughout the period in which they're going to be, you know, practicing on actual children. But until you really get deep into the year, there's a lot of things that on paper seem obvious. And then when you start doing it, like, oh my gosh, it didn't work in reality. You know, they have to have a sense of humor about it, kind of a certain security and confidence, not only just to plow through it, but also to be transparent with the school leader and with the both sets of mentors. I've tried to tell everybody, even in the interviews, that we expect them to fail, but we also expect them to bounce back and learn from their failure. But they're only going to learn if they admit when they make a mistake or that something they tried just didn't work. And as long as they're committed to keep trying and to try with the benefit of experience from people who actually know what they're doing, from years and years of experience and years of coaching, you know, hundreds of teachers, I think they'll be in a really, really good spot. I also think from a faith perspective, people who come to Boston, I think they will be, I was astounded when I moved here from New York. The depth of the faith community here, despite everything that's gone on in Boston, you know, 20 years ago and plus, is absolutely astonishing. So there will be a faith community among the people who come here, but there's a much larger community, faithful young adults here, that is just staggering. And so we're arranging for, I shouldn't call them kids because they're adults, but given my age, we're arranging for these kids. We're organizing their apartments. I've got real estate people all lined up and stuff like that. But we're also very intentionally trying to create a community of people among the teachers we bring in with a broader faith community. So we're doing monthly social events, which I joke, everybody is pre-qualified for marriage when they walk into the room. they could start hunting for their soulmates. My wife and I haven't been to a good wedding in a while. So the only condition would be letting them in the room that if they marry anybody, they have to invite my wife and I to the wedding.
Perfect.
They don't invite me, they should invite her because my wife's the one who picks out the wedding gifts anyway. But but I think what they'll find is a really, really beautiful community. And I think in the tough days as a beginning teacher, I think their faith can sustain them in a very meaningful way. Mm-hmm. I think without that sense of community, without that camaraderie, I think it would be very difficult. And I think the missionary part of this, that we're literally focused on saving the souls of the children that are sitting in their classrooms. You have to remember, no matter how difficult it is or whatever kind of cross you're asked to carry, you're doing it for a higher purpose than yourself. And I think that's what gets people, one, to sign up. I also think that's what sustains them on their worst days.
Absolutely.
When something just doesn't work that they tried and they were confident, you know, when they wrote out the lesson, it was going to be spectacular and it just crashes and burns. They have to remember that at the end of the day, there's a larger purpose here and that we do believe that God's at work in all of this. And he and our mentors will help carry them through whatever dark days they find. And then if they get through the first year, I think a very high percentage of them will stay with it. But I think the beauty of our view of this is we're lighting a bunch of candles in as many classrooms as we can possible. If some of them, after a couple of years, decide to go somewhere else, that those candles, symbols of faith, end up spreading across the country wherever they go, I think that's actually a quite beautiful thing. And we'll be blessed that we had 2 years with them. And beyond that, it's all up to God, you know, where their life will lead, whether they end up becoming parents or they end up, deciding to go to business school or whatever. their next step might be. But I know people that, you know, I have a really good friend who went to India in the Peace Corps in the 1960s. Now, you know, in his 60s or 70s, whatever age he is. But he still gets together for regular reunions. I mean, the sense of camaraderie from being part of a grand mission that's bigger than yourself is a formative experience, I think, in a young person's life. I know he looks back on his time in India and the Peace Corps as, you know, like a couple of the best years of his entire life. And he's had a pretty spectacular life, but he looks back with great regard for that amount of time. So whether they stick with the vocation of teaching or not, I think they're going to look back on the time that they spend with us with a great amount of pride and satisfaction that they plowed through it, became a better teacher as a result, but they also became a better human being from going through the experience.
Amen. This is Leonard DiLorenzo. You're listening to Church Life Today on the Spoke Street Media Network. I'm joined today by Thomas Carroll, Secretary of Education, Superintendent of Schools for the Archdiocese of Boston. Thinking about that formative community for especially the young teachers, in some ways, that's what you're hoping to create in the schools themselves, as a formative community in which young people and perhaps their families as well can be formed in and nourished by the Catholic faith. Now, the Archdiocese of Boston is one of the oldest, one of the most storied dioceses in the United States, founded in early 1800s, I believe. As you already alluded to, it's been marked by both great scandal, but also great beauty, rich in tradition. But for recent years, decades, as I understand it, the enrollment in your Catholic schools has been trending downward. And then over the last year and a half or so, from what I've read, you've increased enrollment across the archdiocese by about 6,000 students. So I think you said earlier you have somewhere north of 32,000 students total. So that's a significant percentage increase, 6,000 student increase. To what do you attribute that growth?
Oh, I think it's very direct. First of all, the track record is pretty grim long-term. I mean, Cardinal Dolan, who I used to be in New York and worked with him as an advocate on school choice for about 8 years, but he had a phrase which was quoted in America Magazine, which is, Catholic education has become hospice care, meaning we know the patient's going to die. We're just trying to mitigate the pain on the way out. And he said it with kind of his dark Irish sense of humor, not as like what he was the desired state, but just kind of a wry observation. But there was some truth to that. In 1965, more than 5 million students were enrolled in Catholic schools. The latest numbers last year were 1.6 million now. It's been pretty much a straight line down. The major exceptions are the Archdiocese of Miami and Lincoln, Nebraska. Had a series of like four or five phenomenal bishops since the mid-60s. And those two places, Miami because of immigration, Lincoln, Nebraska, because incredible leadership of the hierarchy across a very long period of time. But what happened is COVID hit, and it sounds odd to say COVID's been good for Catholic schools, but it was, you know, to borrow from Charles Dickens and reverse the order, it was the worst of times and the best of times. So the worst of times when it first hit, Catholic schools are all about community. The community was in a sense shattered temporarily because we were not allowed to stay open for the first few months. And because people didn't really know how it was spread and so forth. We also had a financial crisis because nobody was going to churches. We had no money coming into the collections. People weren't paying tuition when they lost their jobs. So it was a very challenge, and we ended up closing some schools in that time period. And then we were looking towards the fall, and I said to the Cardinal, and I think at first he thought I was being dramatic, but it was being literally true, that if the trends continued, we could have had to close another 24 schools that fall, is in 2019.
Wow.
And we've never closed schools in the middle of the school year, but it was so difficult to predict what the enrollment would be in the fall or how this would all play out. There were so many different factors. Or what would happen with the broader economy? Would it just keep collapsing or would somehow it would come back? And, you know, with buildings continue being closed, we couldn't predict really. My brother's a pretty accomplished economist, but nobody could predict accurately what's going to happen. So my recommendation was that we don't, you know, we'll just wait. We'll just have to wait and see. And it's going to be messy if we have to do it. And then in the middle of July, the two teachers unions in Massachusetts, interestingly, not the school superintendents, announced after the governor said he wanted all the schools to open, and we were ready. We had told the governor unless we were banned by the health department, we were definitely opening. There was no way we were going to be closed. So we were in that moment when the governor said, you know, let's go. We didn't have to have a meeting or think about it. Like, we just said, okay, all of our schools are going to be open. And then we had to figure out all the logistics, technology wise and everything else, how we were going to do it. And then the other side, the teachers unions, on July 15th of that year, I'll never forget the date, they held this unbelievable press conference in which they say not only are they opening 30 days late, again, the union's not the technical leaders of the school.
Right.
So kind of telling people who's the boss, right, in the district schools. And then after the 30 days, they were going to be remote. And they just weren't showing up. So I sat there just like literally dumbfounded when I watched the press conference or heard of the press conference. And then when that hit the nightly news at 6 o'clock, our phone started ringing across 100 Catholic schools and didn't stop till the middle of October.
Wow.
We gained 4,400 students from the moment, literally, we were going down. We had dropped 5,700 kids until that press conference. And then literally, soon as it hit the nightly news, the numbers started going in the other direction and climbed up. Then the following year, we said, well, the tide came in, but the tide could go out. So the next year, we said, well, all these public school people who quick switched to us didn't plan on paying tuition, right? So maybe this is a one-time
temporary.
So we opened Welcome Arms, but we thought there was a good chance they were all going to leave. Then they all stayed, and then we got another 1,300 or so that came in.
Wow.
Mostly public school people who regretted that they didn't switch the year before.
Wow.
Kind of like, we made a big mistake trusting the public schools would figure it out. Because in Massachusetts, they were closed most of the day. Now, a lot of the schools, frankly, are like remedial factories. And a lot of the parents, by the way, who came to us the second wave, asked us, parents almost never want their kids to be put back a grade or held back. The parents were begging us to hold their kid back. And this is like kids that would have gone into ninth grade. They want us to keep in eighth grade. Most kids don't want to be kept in eighth grade when they're on the brink of
high school, tell you, I wanted to get out as soon as possible. Yeah.
Right. So, but the parents go like, we think we've literally, like, parent after parent, hundreds of parents told us, our children learned absolutely nothing in the past year. And we're not confident with them moving forward because the ripple effect of them stumbling unprepared grade after grade is going to be problematic. Other parents who had the wherewithal to keep their kids on track despite the public schools phoning it in, they started getting alarmed that there was such a focus on remediation that their kids who were doing fine would be completely ignored. And then they figured we didn't have that problem because we didn't lose the year. We were busy at work the whole time. So they switched our side and they've been really, really happy. So I think the gravitational pull of 60 years of decline is going to come back at some point. Sure. I don't think we've repealed gravity. And we are working like as furiously as we can. Like every problem we've ever had in any school, we basically have been given this 2-year breather to get our act together. And so we've been working with all of the schools to try to whatever issues they needed to fix, like fix them now. The people who took that moment, this is true across the country, who took this, and we also got a lot of federal money, COVID money,
right,
that helped financially sustain the schools during this period. Whoever took that moment to really sharpen their message for enrollment, to kind of think through their strategy, their positioning in the market, because it's a highly competitive educational market in Massachusetts. Those schools will be on for a really long time. The people who just got fat and happy and took it all for granted because suddenly they have all this enrollment. Well, the enrollment wasn't really because of them. It was partly because of us because people trusted us, but it partly was a negative decision that they were fleeing somebody else. So long haul, the argument for Catholic schools isn't a negative message. The long haul message is we do some stuff much better than any other school.
Yeah.
And we're proud of that. And there have been studies, objective studies, which we routinely outscore, you know, public schools in Massachusetts. So we have a lot of good stuff to talk about, but that doesn't mean that every single school is perfect. So we've been working really, really hard so we come out of this strong.
Well, Tom, I imagine that a number of those students who came over, whether in the first wave of the 4,400, the first year or the second wave that you said over 1,000, a good number of them were probably not Catholic. Maybe you had a good chunk of them were Catholic students, but For those, especially who aren't Catholic or are coming in, what is it that you hope for them to encounter in your Catholic schools that may be distinctive or novel or fresh for them and their families?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, this is Boston, right?
Oh, well, that's true.
Right. So virtually everybody is at least nominally Catholic, okay, right? To different people, right? In terms of like self-identified Catholics, you know, probably 80%+ of the people in our schools before, during, and after COVID have been self-identified Catholics. I think what people see is, one, I think in this moment in which a lot of people were isolated in multiple ways, even if their kids were going to school, a lot of people are still working at home. I'm in my office, like nobody else is here, right? Because like people are working remote and stuff like that. That's happening across the entire economy. People are looking for connection and community. And one of the hallmarks of Catholic schools, which often don't go remarked, but it's really a central part of Catholicism, is the sense of community. The reason we come together, you know, in a church for communion is because we're coming together as a community. So that's a huge part of it. There are some basics we get really, really well. Like the schools are all safe. The kids are very disciplined. It's very orderly. Some people take that for granted until they experience things that don't look like that.
Right.
But one of the things that saved us, we had very low number of cases, virtually no spread within schools, is because Catholic schools are really good at getting kids to follow instructions. We don't have as many nuns with rulers as we used to have, but it turns out in a pandemic, having kids following instructions, yeah, you know, around health protocols,
right,
and even the architecture of school, which we're all in nice, neat, perfectly aligned rows, right? Everybody's facing the back of somebody else's head. You know, that kind of old-fashioned style of rooms is really good in a pandemic. So I think that part, kind of the orderliness, is good. The academic rigor, we've had a really strong record in that for a long time. We have some astonishing public schools in Massachusetts, like some of the best in the entire country, but we also have some of the worst at the same time. And so I think consistently, we do a really good job at academic rigor and dramatically higher graduation rates than you often see in urban public schools around the country. So I think people appreciate that. There's something to be said that we actually wanted the kids to come back.
Right.
Right. We actually, I mean, it sounds funny to say, like,
You wanted to be with
them. I'm not saying the public school teachers don't love children, because I think they do. But the teachers union, which spent since the 1960s, a lot of time setting up PTAs, Parent Teacher Association, the whole political theory of that is that the interest of parents and teachers is aligned. That's why you're together for common cause. What happened in the public, and I believe that's true, where we believe that parents are the first educators, just as a matter of kind of Catholic theology. On the public school side, it became very clear that the interest of the teacher union leadership and the parents was absolutely not the same. Every parent, Catholic or not, in any system wanted their kids in school. I joke, part of that is everybody said they only want to spend more time with their family. They did, and then they decided, here, you can have them back. So that may be part of it. But
right.
But I think they realized it was not good for their kids not to be around other kids. And the teachers realized it was not, even though we did this hybrid thing and all that stuff, and we did it probably as great as anybody, you know, it's not the model for education for Catholic schools, you know, across the country. So they all wanted to have the kids in front of them. You know, everybody wanted to be back together, and the parents wanted them back together for all the obvious reasons. The way some of the teachers unions have acted, and again, I don't ascribe this to the rank and file teachers. I suspect a lot of them wanted to come back. So for example, in the city of Boston, the mayor, Mayor Marty Walsh, who's now the U.S. Labor Secretary, said to the teachers and the unions, at least for special ed, for kids with receiving special ed services and for homeless children, at least bring the teachers back for them.
Yeah.
Right. And his argument was pretty simple, that you can't provide the services like in everybody's individual home. And for homeless kids, how do you do remote if a kid's living on a street with his parents?
Right.
On a cardboard box.
Right.
Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no,
it's like
absolutely.
The humanity of saying, like, you know, kind of the modern version of Marie Antoinette's Let Him Eat Cake. It's like, okay, so everybody's got a Google Chromebook, but the homeless people who don't have a power supply, well, the heck with you.
Right.
They did it for 1 week and then they called it off. The teachers union
the
called
teachers
it off.
Union
the mayor
did.
And the Boston teachers union, the mayor was flabbergasted. He couldn't believe it. And it's like, you do realize that these kids actually need these services, like what you're doing to these. There's a reason, you know, all the committees in special ed, you know, evaluate parents and everybody else signed off an agreement. And then the other aspect to it that I think is unconscionable is every year in every school in America, new kids show up. Right. Yeah. And so they get acclimated throughout the year. Well, if the public schools close and the new kids are in the classroom, it means they're on a Zoom with a teacher they've never met, with kids they've never met. Like, how awkward is that? Like, I couldn't imagine seven-year-old kid or a nine-year-old kid or, you know, all the angst in middle school and high school. Like, that's, you literally know nobody you're talking, like, how could you ever expect that to end well? So I think there's a host of social, emotional, psychiatric issues that spring out of the decision to say, we're just not showing up for work. So I think the difference, like, we were not, that's not where, as Catholics, there is no way we could have reached those decisions the way they did. And again, I'm not blaming individual teachers. The teachers who came in to take care of this kids with special ed services and the homeless kids, they wanted to be there. And their teacher union would not allow them to continue to be there. Wow. Everybody had to be treated the same. You couldn't have some people showing up and some people not.
This is Leonard DiLorenzo. You're listening to Church Life Today on the Spoke Street Media Network. I'm joined by Thomas Carroll, Secretary of Education, Superintendent of Schools, Archdiocese of Boston. Can we take a little bit of time and focus in on one of your schools in particular? And that is the first new Catholic school in Boston in the last half century, which is the Lumen Verum Academy. You helped to found this school. You serve as president. Tell us about what makes Lumen Verum distinctive and the founding vision of this school.
Well, first of all, for those of you who didn't take Latin in Catholic school, Lumen Verum stands for true light, as in the light of Christ, but also that we want each child to be their own light of Christ wherever their life takes them. So the idea of the school is we wanted to cast a net across the entire archdiocese, which is a very large archdiocese. And so we wanted to have any parent who is concerned about their child retaining the faith to have a school whose organizing principle above any other consideration was making sure that a child who in fifth grade believed whatever their mom told them about religion, which I think is most fifth graders. Then what happens in sixth and seventh grade, they start asking questions, sometimes snarky questions. I know my own kids ask some snarky questions. And I always said to them, like, we want you to ask questions. Like, Catholicism has been around for 2000 years. We have 1.3 billion Catholics. There's nothing you could say that's going to like shock anybody. It's like a kid goes to confession and things like, you know, said a bad word to their mother, or their sister. Like, that's the first time this has ever heard that. Right. So I'm going like, go at it. Right. But we want to make sure that those kids, you know, get the proper answers. So there's a bunch of cases, but the idea is to take the kid from fifth grade, make sure they get all the way to 12th grade with not only their faith intact, but actually deepened and much more sophisticated. So there's a couple aspects to this. First, it's a blended learning school, meaning 4 days virtual, 1 day in person. The 1 day in person, because faith formation includes obviously accompaniment. It is an in-person activity. The virtual, because we could reach families anywhere in the archdiocese. And also because from an educational perspective, if we went virtual for the academic program, the entire globe becomes our extended faculty. So we have the Sisters of Life coming from five different locations around the country, 2 days a month. George Weigel is teaching totalitarianism in the 20th century through the life of St. John Paul II. I started at a call with them and I said, before we're done talking, I'm going to convince you to be a sixth grade teacher in Boston. And he's like, how do I hang up on this guy? But when I explained it all to him, he was very interested. We have Jason Efford, Chris Stefanik, Ambassador Edward Habsburg, who's a descendant of the Habsburg dynasty that's been a monarchy for 700 years, and including the period of being the Holy Roman Emperor was a Habsburg. So he's teaching both that period of European history to our, now we have 6th, 7th, and 8th, but it's going to be a 6th through 12th high school eventually. So we just have like this extraordinary array of people. I'm recruiting somebody right now from Brazil. Well, I'm working on immigration issues to get him to teach in a school in Boston. But while we're waiting to do that, He's going to be teaching virtually. He speaks five different languages, graduate of Thomas Aquinas College, a classics major. And so he's going to be going to University of Dallas to finish his graduate degree, but also teaching our kids in Boston.
Wow.
So it's something like the upside of technology. People have seen a lot of the downside during the pandemic, but the upside is you could have a kid who went to school, a bricks and mortar school, college in California, who lives in Brazil, gets a graduate degree at University of Dallas and teaches a class in Boston. I mean, it's just kind of mind blowing. So literally everybody that I've asked, I have Charlie Camosi, who's at Fordham.
Oh, yeah.
As one of our, what we call distinguished guest lecturers. He made the mistake of telling me he was on a sabbatical.
So Charlie's got to know better than that. That's the cardinal sin when you're on sabbatical.
Charlie. So he's got a fabulous book called Resisting Throwaway Culture. Yeah. So I asked him to design a course around the chapters of that book, which is the Catholic Church has positions on abortion, assisted suicide, pornography, immigration, bioethics, that I think to a lot of people, including kids who graduate from a school, seem like random political positions. But there is a consistent moral theology that undergirds all of it. And I said, look, if we do nothing else as Catholic educators, we have to make sure that nobody gets out of 12th grade without understanding that simple fact, that the moral foundations of our positions go back 2,000 years. They have nothing to do with the political parties that were created a couple thousand years later in the United States, in which both parties have, and just in the last 5-6 years, have changed their positions on almost every issue with kind of a surprising regularity in the last 5-6 years. So for people to understand that when we take a position, we're taking a timeless theological position. We're not, you know, we may advocate in a lobbying sense for a point of view, but the foundation of that point of view is not a political point of view. It's a moral, theological point of view. And he said just the level of play with 6th, 7th, and 8th graders rivals what's happening at the college level these days.
Oh, yeah.
And the kids are much more open than a lot of kids in college are now coming in, almost like too ideological, too, I would call Stalinist in terms of the thought process, that they're not truly open in the classical sense of a university being a place where you could consider all ideas with respect and regard to each other.
Well, I was going to say this is probably refreshing for Charlie, because I've talked to him about teaching on the college level, and that's precisely what he's talked about before. Yeah, it must be refreshing to have the engagement.
I won't pre-announce it, but there is a professor in Notre Dame who's going to be a distinguished guest lecturer for our kids. We'll be 6 through 9 next year. That's not ready to be announced yet. Don't know whether he's gotten approval yet, so I'll have to find out. But the point is, we're getting, it's so unusual for kids at this level. And the school's small. It started at 20 kids. We're going to build it up to, you know, 250, 300, 350 kids once all the grades are planned out. But the kids are getting, right now, there's 7 teachers, 2 co-principals. They're getting extraordinarily deep theological training from our teachers. But the Catholic intellectual tradition has also been embedded in every single subject. And so one of the students commenting on their teachers had them each comment on what they liked most about the school. And then one of them said, I like how Mr. So-and-so makes me see God through mathematics.
Wow.
I didn't do the follow-up question to say, explain that to me. I'm going like, so Jesus had 12 apostles and one potato. 12
subtract one, add 11. One back. Right. There you go.
Right. So we generally allow people who are not Catholic to teach in our schools. Almost most of our faculty is Catholic, but some people aren't. But in this school, everybody is practicing devout Catholic. And we have them in front of the parents and in front of the children in a church recite the profession of faith and the same oath of fidelity that priests recite.
Wow.
Which I first saw at Thomas Aquinas College, and I thought it was actually spectacularly beautiful. And so we've done that at Lumen Verum. So it's a mixture of all the classes of Socratic, which is similar to Thomas Aquinas College. So it's a mixture of like a different delivery method. It's blended learning. A lot of our high schools don't have chaplains anymore. The Cardinal just the other day announced, even though we have 20 kids in this class, that he's taken a priest who's at the seminary as the dean of men at the seminary, charge of their formation. He's now leaving there in June and becoming the dedicated chaplain for Lumen Verum Academy. And I think it's because the Cardinal realizes that the vocations that are going to come out of the school, we've been flooding the zone with priests, seminarians, religious sisters, religious brothers. And we've had seminarians come in and tell their discernment stories to the kids. And the reason for all of this is if we don't do a good job at bringing kids to understand the Catholic faith and bring them closer to God, and we don't generate vocations, there is not going to be a church left in a generation. Simple as that. And so I think the fate of the children in our custody eternally is at stake, and the future of the church and the inside of the church. No disrespect to everybody else in the building that I'm sitting in now, but there's no part of the Catholic Church that can save the Catholic Church itself except for Catholic schools, because the future of the church is its children. And if people who come out of Catholic schools don't believe in Catholicism, we're finished. So I think we have to go back to our roots, which is go back to the evangelizing mission. And that's why I'm recruiting principals who believe in it. I've brought in 25 new principals in the last 2 years, and I'm going to bring in an awful lot of teachers as well who agree with that kind of missionary approach to education.
Well, folks, if you'd like to find out more about Lumen Verum Academy, just go ahead and search for that online. You'll find out more about the school. But Tom, if people are interested, especially people looking to teach or to help lead Catholic schools, how do they connect with you, with the Archdiocese, to come forward and make themselves available?
Yeah, first of all, I'm a very easy person to find, which my wife sometimes regrets because I'm doing phone calls at 11 o'clock at night almost every day. But my email is very simple. It's thomas_carroll, spelled the Irish way, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, at rcab.org for Roman Catholic Archdiocese Boston. And then our website is CSO, as in Catholic School Office, csoboston.org.
And then get started there.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. So if you can't remember any of that, you could just look up the Boston Archdiocese.
And come forward.
Google will get you to the
come
site.
Come one, come all. That's right. Well, thanks so much for spending this time with us today. This has just been an engaging and illuminating conversation.
Enjoyed the conversation as well. Thank you for having me on.
I've been talking today with Thomas Carroll, Secretary of Education, Superintendent of Schools for the Archdiocese of Boston. We're glad that not only he was here, but you were here with us also. Thanks for joining us on Church Life Today.
Church Life Today is a production of Spoke Street Media and the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame, and is brought to you in part by Notre Dame FCU and our listeners.
This show is a production of the Spoke Street Media Podcast Network. For more great podcasts, visit SpokeStreet.com.
Elevate 150 Financial Checkups at Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Here's how it works. Go online and schedule a 30-minute phone call. They'll guide you through your credit report to find ways to improve your financial health. Then they'll send $150 in your name to Redeemer Radio. For information, visit NotreDameFCU.com/elevate. You already share our values. Why not share in our benefits? Notre Dame FCU.